you're traveling to realize that different people have, they love their way of living. And I get that all the time in Europe. I'm in a little village here in Italy, and every summer they have a festival where the older kids teach the younger kids how to make a good ravioli. That's just heartwarming to see traditions going down from generation to generation. Here's a little town in France where the Chamber of Commerce thought it was worth investing in orbs that let people develop a good nose so they can distinguish the fine points between the different wines that they make in that region. I guess in this town, a good nose is a life skill worth investing in. Europeans love to spend too much for a loaf of bread in order to buy it from the person who baked it. Now, that's a goofy notion here because, you know, it's just, it's too expensive. But that's part of their family values, you could say. Here, we're so excited about having a freezer in the garage, so we only have to go shopping every 2 weeks. And over there, they got a tiny refrigerator under the sink because they want to have to go shopping every morning because that's when they check in with their neighbors. Again, it's not right or wrong, but when you hear people here talking about family values, I like to share a different kind of family values, you see. Europeans love their fine wines, and they know how to fill it up really cheap. This is a filling station for wine in Italy. I mean, you can't believe it's the cheapest liquid you can buy in Italy is table wine. This woman just hiked from Paris all the way to the northwest corner of Spain, Santiago de Compostela, on the Camino de Santiago. And I've been really interested in this lately. And we filmed it last summer. And it'll be out on one of our new shows you'll see on KQED. And I've never done the Camino. If I ever have a month where I could do the Camino, I think it'd be a life-changing experience. I've never met anybody who did this pilgrimage trail that didn't have an incredible, valuable time. And it was a big deal in the Middle Ages, then it almost died away, and then it's had a real renaissance in the last generation, and now 100,000 people a year are hiking that Camino. And I like to be in Santiago de Compostela, a great city, to be on that square at 10 o'clock in the morning when the pilgrims come in, completing their journey. And you see these sunburned, tattered shoes and walking stick people finally get there, and they plant their foot on that scallop shell, which is what they've been waiting for, embedded in the pavement, and they look up at that Cathedral of St. James, and they're overwhelmed with jubilation. And I don't even know what's motivating them. You know, some of them are Roman Catholics doing the typical Catholic pilgrimage, but more of them are on personal quests. But it's just kind of fun to think there are people on personal quests. All over the world, smart societies deal with the same problems we deal with different solutions. In Switzerland, you pay a lot of money for the garbage bags, but it includes disposal. So whether you like it or not, that bag is paying for disposal, and you put it out in the morning, and it's gone. The truck picks it up. In England, you don't have stop signs. You've got roundabouts, which is kind of fun if you like driving without stopping. In Amsterdam, you've got a four-story bicycle garage right in front of the train station, and so many people bike in Amsterdam, it's hard to find a place to park your bike there. People in Europe do not like junk mail. So they've got a very high-tech solution. It's called a decal. They stick it on their mailbox. It says either yes or no to junk mail. And most people say no. I'm fascinated by how America sort of is inclined to legislate morality. I'm thinking of prostitution and recreational drugs and so on. Now, everybody here has morals. I bet everybody here has a different morality. You know, we're not exactly the same. And I don't know who can say whose morality in this room is right or wrong. We're all moral people, and it can be different. It's hard, it's futile to legislate morality. At least that's what my European friends have told me. In fact, my European friends oftentimes tell me this line, which the Europeans just really embrace. A society has to make a choice, tolerate alternative lifestyles or build more prisons. And then they always follow that by reminding me, you Americans incarcerate 8 times as many people per capita as we do here in Europe. Either you guys are inherently more criminal or something screwy with your laws. And it's thought-provoking. And we're not getting better at that, we're getting worse at this incarceration game. Prostitution's an interesting thing. I don't think anybody would say prostitution's good. I think it's pretty clear, though, that no matter what kind of laws are against it, there's going to be lonely men who pay for sex. That's always been the case. It always will be the case. Some societies are interested more in harm reduction than legislating morality. In most of Europe, brothels are legal and taxed. And if you're a prostitute, you can't have a license unless you're checked by a nurse and you are not spreading diseases. And in Europe, prostitutions ideally are independent business people. They are unionized, they rent their space, they make their money. When they have a problem client, they push their emergency button, and a pimp does not come to their rescue, but a policeman does. The police come to the rescue of the prostitutes when they've got a bad customer. Now, it's not foolproof, and there's a lot of problems associated with prostitution, but it doesn't have the disease and the violence that other countries that would be more inclined to legislate morality would be dealing with. It's just a pragmatic harm reduction approach to a persistent problem, and I think we can learn from it. And it's a fascinating tourist attraction. When I'm in Scandinavia, in the spring, and that's normally, well, it's like May or June, I'm always struck by how many drunk, noisy teenagers are running around in decorated trucks. And I asked somebody finally, what is with this? And they said, it's graduation time. And when the kids graduate, the parents rent a car with a driver or a truck, the kids decorate it, and the parents host keggers. And the kids go from house to house just getting blitzed. I said, now this is really strange to me. And they said, well, you know, we don't want our kids drinking and driving. And we believe that, you know, whatever we want, the kids are going to drink on their graduation. So rather than just say no and so on, we just want to make sure they don't drink and drive and get killed. So we pay for the driver and we host the keggers. And nobody lies, and nobody dies, and it's all okay on Monday, you see? So it's just, it would be a very tough sell here in America for parents to pay for the keggers. But we have the dead teenagers. They don't, you know? I mean, it's just a different approach. And we go to such heroics to save one little life, and then we're so bullheaded about other things, and we lose hundreds of lives, you see? So it's just fascinating for me to try to be open-minded and respect the fact that there are people who tackle problems differently. I was recently at a Starbucks in Zurich. I needed to go to the toilet, so I went downstairs, step into the bathroom, and blue lights. The whole place was illuminated with blue lights, and I thought, oh, I get it. I can't see my veins. I couldn't shoot up if I wanted to. Frustrating. And it occurred to me, all these people with public bathrooms are in a society where they've got a lot of junkies, a lot of needle addicts, and they don't want them hanging out in their warm, cozy place to shoot up. It's natural. So they have blue lights, and these people have to go somewhere else. Across the street, you've got a machine that used to sell cigarettes, and now it sells government-subsidized syringes. I bought them. They're cool little souvenirs. There's like one franc and you get two. They're very generic. Nobody's passing needles around, that's for sure. I can promise you that. I never noticed this, but for years, they're all over the place. When you go to Switzerland next time, look at the cigarette machines. They're selling syringes. You see, it's just a low-key way where they've got a harm reduction approach to a persistent drug problem. Okay, so you got your junkies, there's no place to shoot up, they got their needles. Down the street, there's a heroin maintenance clinic. It's called a Cafe Fix. It's just tucked away in a little side street, not in everybody's face, but it's got a lot of wasted junkies there. It's an ugly scene, it's horrible. These people are just really in a very difficult straits, but they've got counseling, they've got nurses, they've got government help to maintain their heroin addiction and get them off that and back into productive society, and they're not dying. Last year, the United States lost 18,000 people to heroin overdoses. Europe, with more people and more, you know, easy laws, lost less than half of us, 8,000 people. For years, I've taken American tourists around Europe, and they see these wasted junkies, and they say, they think these liberal Europeans, they got so many people on hard drugs. No, they don't have any more than we do. Their people are just still alive, and they're not in jail. You see, it's a fundamental difference. They're in the public. They've got their heroin maintenance clinics. Now, it's not rock solid, easy going. They don't have all the solutions, but they're being creative about their drug problems because they've got serious drug problems just like we do. Europe is not soft on drugs. I believe Europe is smart on drugs. It's just different. It's pragmatic. It's motivated not by how many people do you lock up, but their policies are motivated by harm reduction. A phrase you couldn't even use in drugs policy circles in the United States for 8 years. As soon as you said the word harm reduction, your proposal would be just tossed out and not considered because, you know, that's a different sort of approach. Marijuana has been in the news here, hasn't it? I bet you're probably tired of hearing about it. But I just think it is fascinating to learn about this whole prohibition of marijuana from a European perspective. I've been speaking out on this for 10 years now. I've been a board member of NORML, and I go all over the United States giving talks about drug policy, and I fly home early from Europe to go to Hempfest in Seattle. I get a talk at 4:20. It's a real honor. But I'll tell you, people in the drug policy discussion that I'm in, you know, lawyers and judges and ACLU people and doctors and these kind of people, are not in favor of marijuana. They just really believe that it would be pragmatic to treat it not as a criminal problem, but as a health problem and as an education challenge. And what I get to do is inject a little bit of European experience into this. Because in Europe, a joint is about as exciting as a can of beer. This is a coffee shop in Amsterdam, and it's a business. And they're all over the place. Every town in Holland has its coffee shops. And you step inside, and it's hard to know what to pay for, what to buy. I go there for my guidebook work. It's my research. And I come in, and anytime I'm doing anything for my research, I'm trying to figure out what's going to be confusing to my travelers. So you step into a coffee shop, the first thing that's confusing is you don't know what to buy. It's impossible to know what's for sale. I say, where's the menu? How do I know what's going on here? They say, well, because of the laws, we cannot advertise. You need to push this button and physically hold it down, which will light the menu so you can see what we've got for sale. Now, I just say that because it's a complicated thing when you legalize or decriminalize marijuana. How are you going to regulate it? And that's what California has been, I think, quite admirably discussing and dealing with. But obviously, if you're in the discussion like I am, you don't want billboards advertising marijuana. You don't want kids having access to it. And anybody who drives intoxicated by anything should have the book thrown at them. At least that's the European feeling. No advertising. The customer has to take the initiative to illuminate the menu so you can see what you want to buy. Now, the interesting thing is, a lot of Americans think, no way, we're not going to legalize marijuana because there's a whole reservoir of people wishing they could just ruin their lives with abusing drugs if only it was legal. And what Europe has found is, you legalize it and consumption does not change. And I would bet anything that if you legalize it here in America, there might be a little blip up, but generally consumption would not change. People want to smoke, do. It just wouldn't be a crime anymore. In Portugal, for 10 years, the consumption of all drugs has been legal. And it's not even an issue. It's not an issue. It's so silly that we would have 80,000 people in jail today in our country. 80,000 for smoking marijuana. That we would arrest 800,000 people every year. 800,000 people with a record now. Most of them are minorities and poor people who don't have the wherewithal to get around it. And now they can't get a loan. They're forever marked. They can't, you know, this is a real interesting challenge. And what they found in the Portugal is that the only thing gateway about marijuana is if it is illegal. Then you have to get it from people who have a vested interest in getting you hooked on something much more addictive and more profitable. So it's a challenging thing. And I just think it's really interesting to go to Europe, if you want, and learn about how they deal with it. Because per capita, by every estimate, our governments and their governments, Americans smoke twice the marijuana per capita that Europeans do. And the Dutch smoke less than the European average. There's no indication that laws impact per capita consumption. You could make a case that it's inversely correlated. So it's just fun to work on. It's fun to think about. And this is something that I've been doing a lot lately. And I speak out on marijuana because I can, basically. A lot of people agree with me, but they're scared to death to talk about it because if they're a teacher, they'll be out on the street. You can't talk about marijuana in a constructive, honest way in many occupations and still be employed. you know, I don't need to be elected and nobody can fire me. Some people have told me, we know what you think about marijuana and we're not going to take your tours. And all I can think is Europe is going to be a lot more fun without you. So, I mean, this is not a drug policy talk, but it could well be. There's a whole chapter on it, very, very carefully written in the Travel as a Political Act book, because I think it's an important issue when you're spending billions of dollars criminalizing poor people and people of color, frankly. And we're having a losing war. There's no indication that it's ever going to get any better. It's getting worse. And there's a common sense alternative. I was just in Spain. We filmed it. You got marijuana shops in Spain. They hang out their shingle just like you know, Toys R Us. And you go in there, and it's you can't sell marijuana, but you can sell seeds and all the gear to grow it. And everybody can grow marijuana for their own personal consumption. It's not an issue. It's just no longer a crime. And they can deal with it with education and health counseling. It's so exciting to talk common sense into frightened people about this issue. If you want to learn more, I produced a 30-minute program with the ACLU called Marijuana Time for a Discussion. And no TV station in Seattle would let us buy time to air it. I mean, Thighmaster was much more worthy of their time than this. But you can watch it on the web anytime you like if you just Google Rick Steves, marijuana, and ACLU or something like that. What I've learned is from talking to policemen and people who have dedicated their lives to society's problems and helping fix them, and these people realize it's really nice to take the crime out of a soft drug issue. And it doesn't mean have a free-for-all, it means regulate it instead of criminalize it. When you think about Europe's differences from America, it's interesting, isn't it? They're a Christian, capitalist, well-educated, affluent continent just like us, and we have these differences. They're just as passionate about their government by, for, and of the people as we are. But when I think about it, because I've been talking to a lot of people, why are Europeans different than Americans? Well, they have a denser population. They've been around longer than us. I think they have that Rousseau notion of a social contract rather than the Locke. Everybody does everything they want as long as they don't hurt somebody else. That's sort of the rugged individualist that's America. Whereas in a densely populated European situation, you need to all work together more closely. When it comes to government by, for, and of the people, I think we're both into that. But I do think when you look at it, in the United States, we have government by, for, and of the people via the corporations that we own. That's not good or bad. I'm just saying that's what we do. Our government is designed primarily to create a good business environment so the corporations that we own as a society will prosper. It's a reasonable thing. In Europe, on the other hand, it would be government by, for, and of the people in spite of the interest of the corporations that they own. They are just as invested as we are in their stock market per capita. They just have a different sensibility or ethic when it comes to community and sustainability and what is real profit. You would find a law that requires you to pay for the disposal of your car when you buy it in Europe long before you'd find it here in the United States. Because in the United States, that would be considered bad for business, right? And in Europe, that would be considered honest accounting and good for sustainability. So, again, it's not a judgmental thing. It's just when you look at Europe and the United States, you see a difference. And when I want to understand Europe, I want to understand Europe in its extreme. So I go to Scandinavia, the most highly taxed, least church-going, affluent, and by every statistic or measurement, most content societies in the rich world, okay? Highly taxed, least church-going, affluent, content, Scandinavia. Now forget Norway, because they got all that oil, so it's too easy for Norway. But Denmark, all it has is cows. And they can still pull it off too. Okay, when you go to Scandinavia, you find they're religious, but their religion is humanism. You go to the main square and you find not a church, but a city hall. In Stockholm or in Oslo, the city hall stands there bold, with bell towers instead of spires. An area for everybody to gather like a nave, a pulpit, a lectern rather than a pulpit, grandiose mosaics telling not Bible stories, but celebrating heroic individuals who have contributed mightily to their community. It's humanism. When I talk to these Europeans, this man's a school teacher in Switzerland, I love to use them as a sounding board. And I talk with Ollie and his family, and I say, Ollie, how can you Swiss people so docilely pay such high taxes? And he says, without missing a beat, well, what's it worth to live in a country where there's no homelessness, no hunger, and where everybody has access to quality health care and education, regardless of the economic status of their parents? And I just thought, he's not any raging crusader. That's just the ethic of mainstream people in Switzerland. Again, it's not right or wrong. They're a little bit over the border in a lot of ways, and they're learning to be more like us, and we can learn a little bit from them. But they have high expectations for their taxes, and they are generally satisfied with what they're getting from their taxes. I think Americans are very compassionate people, but I think one thing we're not very good at is acknowledging gaps between the haves and have-nots, whether it's in our own society or whether it's between us and the rest of the world. That gap is growing, and when we learn about it, it appalls us, but most of us manage not to learn about it. And when you travel, I've found all my life, I've had the poor world reaching into my window, pulling at my legs. You know, I mean, it's in your face. And unless you're blind and just insist on this ignorance is bliss kind of thing, you acknowledge that these people are desperate. 1 billion people on this planet are trying to live on a dollar a day. That's just a fact. 70% of their family budget is for grain. It's not for fruit or vegetables or meat. That's not a part of, that's not an option. It's just grain. And when the price of grain goes up, you got yourself a crisis, you see. That's just the reality. Now, one thing I've learned in my travels is, even if you're motivated only by greed, if you know what's good for you, you don't want to be filthy rich in a desperately poor world. It's not a good place to raise your kids. You go down to the developing world and you see it. Middle-class neighborhoods pool their money and hire armed guards on every street corner. This is not a rich neighborhood. This is a middle-class neighborhood. And you've got armed guards on every street corner. And rich people are living behind designer fortifications because they're so successful on the backs of their poor. When I tour in El Salvador and Nicaragua, and if I go to sleep on the bus, I hit speed bumps. I know if I open my eyes and look over there, I'm going to see the home of a rich person. You don't build a mansion in the poor world without speed bumps. So angry poor people have to slow down before they drive by and throw something explosive into your yard. And your guards can take down the license plate and go get them. It's just not a very, very nice place to raise your kids. And you see it even in the United States. I was just down in, I think it was Dallas, driving out to Plano. I went past 10 miles of fortified front yards. When people want their kids to get some fresh air, they got chicken wire over their head. So poor kids can't get at them, you know. That's our future if we have a worse gap between rich and poor. A long time ago, people said, wait till you got kids, then you'll get real. Then I had kids, and I tell you, it heightens your sensitivity to this when you've traveled. You love your little girl, and then you see little girls just like your little girl living on a garbage dump in El Salvador. Parents out there in the garbage dump waiting for the daily arrival of the dump trucks when they go like that and dump all these things into there, and they scavenge so they can get enough to feed their kids. That's just, it's a reality. And I thought, wow, this is poignant. And I thought, my little girl's got $5,000 for straight teeth and money left over for whitener. And I thought, every little kid in her classroom has the wherewithal to scrape together $5,000 for straight teeth and money left over for a whitener. And I thought, that's right. I'm a hardworking guy. I love my kids. We have a winning system. My girl gets straight teeth. But that, and it's not a guilt trip. It's just, I need to acknowledge that most little girls on this planet don't have water. They don't even have a mother because she's out walking for water for hours every day and the kids are abandoned. And it occurs to me that for the cost of 2 sets of braces, you could drill a well. For $10,000, you can drill a well and give a thirsty village water. Now, that's not a guilt trip. That's an opportunity. Our kids can have straight teeth and we can still find a way to drill those wells if we wanted to. With what we've spent in the last 10 years for destructive forces, we could wage soft power and be the most beloved corner of this planet, I'll tell you that. For $10,000. For $10,000, you could, remember the, what, well, you can look at your own statistics and so on, but imagine what it costs to keep a guy in arms in Afghanistan. It's necessary for him to be there, okay. But think of the alternative. If you took that money and drilled wells in thirsty towns with kids that are abandoned and taken over by people who hate America and want to raise them with these angry feelings. You got a well. The moms stay home. They nurture their kids. Every morning when they go out to get their water, they pump that well, and what they think is America. Thank God for America. We've got water. That's soft power. Even if all you care about is national security, that's the best deal on the planet. And it'll never sell here. Never. You know why? It's simple. Nobody makes money here when you drill a well there. People make money here when you have a war over there. That's a very poignant thought. We've got some serious problems here to deal with. We've got violent Muslim forces. That's not going to go away. We've got to deal with that smartly. You can't wish it away. You can't clench your fist and pound it away. We've got to understand. We've got to humanize 1 billion Muslims on this planet. It's nothing new. It's been going on for 1,500 years. We've got this incredible gap between the rich world and the poor world, and it's getting worse. And, you know, there's all sorts of opportunities for us to look at this smartly. I always think, I'm so interested in this debt problem and land and everything. When you think about the struggle of poor people on this planet, you think in the Bible, you know, it always says Jesus is concerned about the poor and everything. And the Old Testament says every 50 years you're supposed to have the Jubilee year. That's when you redivide the land and you forgive all the debts. I mean, rich Christians know that God was just kidding. But it actually does say that in the Bible. And you think about the wisdom of that. What it's like when you've got people with no land and no food, and you've got people with all the land, and it breeds violence, and it's not good for the people with all the land. And it's just astute in the interest of the people with all the land, I think, to look at a sustainable kind of affluence rather than an affluence built on the backs of other people. It's a challenge for us. I don't know what necessarily the answers are, but I say that there's a lot of caring people in the United States. There's a lot of ingenuity and power and ability to really accomplish some exciting stuff. And I'll say that we are confronted with some serious challenges, and how we deal with those challenges shaped by our worldview. And every person in here has a different worldview shaped by your life experience. If you have a loved one who was killed in a drunk driving incident, you are really passionate about that issue. If you've got loved ones involved in the war, you're really passionate about, you know, supporting troops. If you've got all sorts of different inputs, for me, travel has been a huge thing. And the value of travel is nothing new. 1,500 years ago, Muhammad said, "Don't tell me how educated you are, tell me how much you've traveled." Thomas Jefferson traveled, and he wrote that travel makes a person wiser, if less happy. We already heard how Mark Twain traveled, and he wrote that travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And I've traveled, and I'll tell you, it's the most beautiful shaper of your worldview. Let me just finish with a moment, kind of a vignette in Turkey. As a tour guide, I love taking travelers to Turkey. And I took my group to a town in eastern Turkey, and I wanted them to meet a dervish, one of those guys who whirl, you know, a monk, a Muslim monk. And I'll just paraphrase what he told me in sort of simple tour guide terms here. I said to this dervish, "We want to see you whirl." And he said, "I'm not a photo op." And, you know, because that's what whirling dervishes do for cruise ships, is they whirl on the dining room floor and everybody eats and takes their photographs, and it's just beautiful. He said, "If you're going to watch me pray, you're going to understand what I'm doing." I said, "Cool." So we go up on his rooftop, and he says, "I'm a follower of Mevlana." He's the prophet of love, kind of the Saint Francis of Muslim faith. And we dervishes, we whirl 5 times a day, and we whirl and get into a trance. And when we whirl, we put one foot in our hometown, our community, our family. The other foot goes around acknowledging the beautiful variety on this planet, all of God's creation. One hand goes up, accepting the love of our Creator, and the other hand goes down like a spout on a tea kettle, showering God's love on His creation. And as a follower of Mevlana, I'm a conduit between the love of God and His creation. And I spin and I meditate on that beautiful idea of our loving Creator and the beautiful world He's given us and the variety and the importance of my home. And I spin and I spin and I think about that. And I remember sitting there on that rooftop with the sun going down in eastern Turkey with my group of travelers there, looking at this guy with his robe billowing out and his head tilting over, thinking, wow, he's really pretty different. And at the same time, he's fundamentally the same. And he's no longer as scary and, you know, kind of different as I used to think of him because I better understand him. And I thought, as a tour guide, I just thought, this is so cool to be able to offer this experience to all these people. And I thought, if we can just go home with that most precious souvenir, that empathy for people who are different than us, and realize that, boy, you know, this the variety in this planet is nothing to fear. It's more something to celebrate. That gives us a beautiful worldview, and that's the most precious souvenir. And then when we engage in our society to help our country better work with the other 96% of humanity, that makes travel a political act. And I think that's a pretty good thing. Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Oh, thanks. Oh, I get to touch Rick's mic. Rick is going to stay up here on stage, and we're going to come up in small groups. And so you, those of you who would have books to sign or would like to talk to Rick, let's come up from this side, and we'll have a party.